Welcome in.
Glad to be here.
Whether you are, actively prepping for a high-stakes strategy meeting or you're just trying to catch up on some of the biggest ideas floating around right now, you are in exactly the right place.
You really are.
You are the essential third person in this conversation, and we are just thrilled you're here with us today.
Absolutely.
Today we have a deep dive that is, frankly, going to completely change the way you look at the daily news.
Oh, without a doubt.
We are exploring a truly fascinating white paper. It's dated March 6, 2026, and it carries a heavy, but incredibly important title.
Very happy.
It's called The Violence Viability Architecture: Life, Ground Governance, and the Future of Civilization.
Yeah, it is a remarkable and, I mean, an incredibly dense piece of work.
Super dense.
Right. And what makes this paper stand out right out of the gate is the methodology behind its authorship.
Which is wild.
It really is. It was written by Dr. Bechara Saleh, who brings this deeply interdisciplinary background. We're talking biology and internal medicine. But, and this is the kicker, it was produced in analytical collaboration with ChatGPT 5.3.
That is just so interesting to me.
Right. So we are looking at a synthesis of human medical and systems thinking expertise combined with advanced AI research synthesis.
So it's pulling from everywhere.
Exactly. It allows the paper to pull from vastly different disciplines, ecology, sociology, neurobiology, and it weaves them all into a single framework.
Which is no small feat.
But not at all. And the paper opens with a quote that, well, it perfectly sets the stage for everything we're getting discussed today.
Let's hear it.
The quote is, "The Earth is a single system, but human societies have not yet learned to govern it as one."
Wow. Yeah, that quote, it actually stopped me in my tracks when I first read it.
It's powerful.
It perfectly encapsulates the ultimate civilizational paradox that we're living in right now. And that is really our mission for this deep dive.
Unpacking that paradox.
Exactly. We want to understand why humanity has unprecedented scientific knowledge, staggering technological capability, massive economic power. Yet everywhere we look, we seem to be drifting towards systemic instability, social conflict, and ecological degradation.
It's a massive contradiction.
We have satellites that can read a license plate from space, algorithms folding proteins, but we are struggling to keep basic social and ecological systems from fracturing.
The contrast is jarring, and for you listening, it is so important to establish how the authors approach this,
Yeah, let's clarify that.
because it dictates how we will navigate the material today. This paper completely bypasses the typical political or ideological debates.
The usual talking points.
Right, the stuff that usually dominates these conversations. We are not going to be engaging in the daily partisan back and forth.
No hot takes today.
Exactly. Instead, this deep dive is looking at the deep, interconnected mechanics of our world. We're looking at ecology. We're looking at how our institutions actually process stress.
And neurobiology, which surprised me.
Yeah, surprisingly, human neurobiology. We're trying to look beneath the surface symptoms to understand the structural architecture of how human societies either thrive or ultimately collapse.
Okay, let's unpack this. The paper introduces a core framework that fundamentally changes how we visualize human societies.
It really shifts the paradigm.
The authors argue that civilizations are complex adaptive systems, and they're made of three interconnected layers.
Three layers, right?
They use this architectural metaphor, which I find incredibly helpful.
Makes it very visual.
Right.
Wow.
So imagine civilization as a massive multi-tiered structure. The bottom layer, the bedrock, is what they call the life ground.
The foundation.
The middle layer consists of our institutions, and the top layer is culture.
Right. Life ground, institutions, culture.
Let's start at the very bottom, because this seems to be where everything else gets its stability.
It is.
The paper uses the term life ground, but how does that differ from what we normally just call, the environment?
That distinction is vital. Often, when we talk about the environment in public discourse, we treat it as something separate from human society.
Like a park we visit on the weekends.
Exactly. It's framed as a backdrop,
Yeah.
nice to have. Or a special interest topic that competes with other topics like the economy or foreign policy.
Right, jobs versus the environment.
Precisely. The authors reject that separation entirely.
Okay.
The life ground is the primary civilizational infrastructure. It is the absolute biophysical basis of human societies.
So it's everything we need to physically exist.
Yes. We are talking about the planetary boundaries, breathable air, stable climatic patterns, freshwater systems, fertile soils, biodiversity, energy flows.
The big stuff.
But it also includes the physical human infrastructures we build to interface with those natural systems.
Like what?
Things like water treatment plants, agricultural networks, and public health systems.
So it's the literal life support system. It's not just, hey, save the rainforest because the rainforest is beautiful. It's that the planet's atmospheric regulation is a load-bearing wall for human survival.
That captures the essence of it perfectly. But we have to push that further into how we actually govern.
Okay, how so?
The paper argues that without this functioning life ground, the higher layers of civilization.
The institutions and culture.
Right. Our markets, our courts, our art. They simply cannot operate. The life ground is the absolute prerequisite for human existence.
Makes sense. If there's no water, there's no stock market.
Exactly. And this introduces what the authors call the civilizational purpose problem.
The purpose problem.
It forces a very uncomfortable question. Are our modern societies built to expand financial power, like GDP and market share? Or are they organized to sustain the conditions for human life?
Wow. Which brings us to a concept in the paper that I honestly had to read 3 times to fully grasp.
It's a tricky one.
John McMurtry's concept of life value onto axiology.
Yes.
I know that sounds like incredibly dense academic jargon.
It is dense.
And it is. But it actually represents a profound shift in how we measure success as a species. Can you translate that into how we might look at our own local communities?
Sure. It is a dense term. But the mechanics of it are quite intuitive once you break it down.
Okay, let's do it.
In our current global economic paradigm, value is largely determined by market price.
Dollars and cents.
Right. If something generates capital, it has value. If it doesn't, it is an externality.
It doesn't count.
Exactly. McMurtry's life value onto axiology argues that value should only be determined by whether a system, policy, or action expands or protects the range of human life capacities.
Human life capacity, so not just making money.
Right. The formal axiom in the paper states that something is of value if, and only if, it enables a more coherently inclusive range of thought, feeling, and action than without it.
Give me a concrete example of that, because that is a massive departure from how we normally calculate progress.
Okay, think about an old growth forest. Under a strict market value paradigm, that forest is fundamentally worth $0 until it is chopped down, processed into lumber, and sold.
The act of destroying it is what creates the value.
Exactly. The destruction is what generates the GDP. But under life value, onto axiology, that forest is recognized as actively performing immense value while standing.
Because it's keeping us alive.
Right. It is purifying the air. It's regulating the local watershed. It's preventing soil erosion and providing habitat.
It's working for us 2847.
Yes. It is expanding the life capacities of the human and ecological communities around it.
So what's a negative example of that?
Conversely, if an economic activity generates billions of dollars in profit, but poisons a local river.
Reducing the health of the community.
Right. Reducing the physical health and cognitive development of the children living in that watershed. Then it is a massive disvalue.
Even if the stock price goes up.
Exactly. It is a failure of the civilizational architecture, right, regardless of what the stock market says.
It totally flips the script. It means a policy isn't evaluated by its financial yield, but by its biological and social yield.
Precisely.
And going back to that architectural metaphor, it makes perfect sense.
The house analogy.
Yeah. Think of the life ground as the foundation of a house.
Right.
The institutions, the governance, the economics, the legal frameworks are the framing, the plumbing, and the electrical wiring.
The middle layer.
And culture, our narratives, our beliefs, our art, our identities, that's the paint, the furniture, and the decor.
Exactly.
If the foundation of the house is actively cracking and sinking into the mud, repainting the living room or arguing over the color of the curtains isn't going to save the house.
Really, it won't.
The foundation has to be secured first.
The house analogy works really well as a starting point.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to remember, this house is a living biological system.
Okay, a living house.
If the plumbing fails, it's more like a blocked artery in a living organism.
Hmm.
The middle layer, institutions, acts as the regulatory layer of this organism.
It processes things.
Right. It takes the raw realities of the life ground and translates them into social organization, distributing resources, managing conflicts, creating rules.
And the culture layer.
The top layer, culture, is the interpretive layer. It provides the symbolic narratives we use to understand our experiences, define our identities, and justify the actions of our institutions.
And the central thesis of the paper is that civilizational stability depends entirely on the alignment between these 3 layers.
Alignment is everything.
If the life ground deteriorates, the foundation cracks. That physical pressure moves upward, stressing the institutions.
Plumbing gets backed up.
Right. If the institutions fail to adapt to that stress, the pressure moves all the way up to culture.
And that's when things get dangerous.
Because culture then starts generating narratives of panic, blame, and fragmentation.
And this isn't just a theoretical model.
No, they have proof.
The paper provides historical case studies to illustrate this concept of cascading fragility.
Cascading fragility.
Where a failure at the biophysical base trickles all the way up and collapses the entire societal structure.
And the first major example they explore is the classic Maya civilization.
Right.
What fascinates me about the Maya example is that it challenges our, you know, our Hollywood perception of how civilizations fall.
Always a sudden catastrophe in the movie.
Exactly. We often picture an invading army or a sudden dramatic volcano, but the paper paints a picture of a slow, grinding biological failure.
A systemic breakdown.
So what happens when this biological house starts failing? What did the Maya collapse actually look like through the lens of this framework?
To understand the collapse, we first have to look at the peak. The classic Maya civilization, roughly between 250 and 900 CE, was incredibly sophisticated.
Very advanced.
Very. They built massive urban centers across the Yucatan Peninsula and Central America. We were talking about tens of thousands of people in heavily centralized cities.
Huge populations, right.
And they were supported by advanced agricultural terracing and massive water management systems.
Water was key.
Crucial. Much of their territory was characterized by seasonal rainfall and porous limestone bedrock.
Meaning the water just drains right through.
Exactly. Meaning surface water was a highly volatile resource.
So their life ground was already delicately balanced. They were completely dependent on their physical infrastructure.
Their reservoirs and canals.
Right, to capture and hold the seasonal rains to survive the dry season.
That's nice. And in the 9th century, paleoclimatic data shows that the region experienced severe, prolonged, multi-decadal droughts.
Decades without enough rain.
In the violence viability framework, this is a massive, sustained life ground stress. The ecological systems that sustained their intensive agriculture and their urban water supplies began to physically fail.
The carrying capacity plummeted. They just ran out of water and everyone starved.
It wasn't just the lack of water. It was how the higher layers of their civilization reacted to the lack of water.
This is where the cascade happens.
Yeah, exactly. As the life ground deteriorated, the stress moved up to the institutional layer.
Okay, the middle layer.
The Maya city-states were heavily centralized and highly competitive. Instead of realizing the carrying capacity of the region had fundamentally changed and cooperated.
To manage the dwindling resources.
Right, or altering their agricultural demands. The institutions rigidified.
They doubled down.
They did.
Yeah.
The city-states actually increased their warfare against one another. They started fighting over the shrinking pie. That is a profound institutional failure.
And then that institutional warfare pushes the stress all the way up to the cultural layer.
Up layer.
Because the rulers of these Maya city-states claimed their power through divine legitimacy.
They were the link to the gods.
Right. They were the intermediaries between the human world and the divine. Their cultural narrative was that the rulers, through their rituals and governance, ensured the cosmic balance.
Which included bringing the rain.
Consider the psychological impact of that cultural narrative failing.
It's devastating.
If your entire societal identity is based on the idea that your king controls the rain and it hasn't rained enough to grow crops for a decade.
The king doesn't just look like a bad manager.
Exactly. The entire cosmological worldview fractures.
The rulers lost their legitimacy.
The cultural narratives that held the society together completely broke down.
The elite monuments stopped being carved.
The society didn't just fail because of the climate. It failed because the ecological stress of the drought interacted with rigid, competitive institutions and a cultural narrative that was entirely inflexible.
And that interaction is what drives cascading fragility.
It's a terrifyingly clear example. And the paper doesn't leave this in the distant past.
No, it brings it right up to the present.
It brings this exact same dynamic into the modern era with its second case study, the Syrian Civil War.
Yes.
And I want to point out to the listener, what makes this paper's analysis of Syria so compelling is that it completely strips away the geopolitics.
The partisan narratives.
The punditry we usually see on the news. It asks us to look purely at the math of the ecology and the structural mechanics of the stress.
Just the mechanics.
It treats the crisis as an engineering failure of a complex system, analyzing the material conditions without endorsing any political faction.
And we need to be very clear here for you listening.
Extremely clear.
We are stripping away the geopolitics completely. We are looking purely at the ecological math and the structural stress. We are not taking sides or endorsing any political faction.
We are just looking at the mechanics of the system.
That objective lens is crucial for systems analysis. When we apply the violence viability architecture to Syria, we start exactly where we started with the Maya.
At the life ground layer.
Between 2006 and 2010, the broader Fertile Crescent region experienced one of the most severe multi-year droughts in its recorded instrumental history.
So another massive drought.
Climatologists have noted that this was likely exacerbated by long-term shifts in global climatic patterns.
And this wasn't just a mild dry spell. This was a catastrophic failure of the agricultural base.
It was devastating. In the northeastern agricultural regions of Syria, which were the breadbasket of the country, rainfall dropped dramatically.
The core of their food supply.
This led to widespread consecutive crop failures. Herders lost massive portions of their livestock. The soil literally dried up.
Total life ground collapse.
Furthermore, this ecological shock was compounded by prior years of groundwater depletion from overpumping. So there was no buffer.
No backup water.
None. As a direct result of this life ground collapse, an estimated 1.5 million people from these rural agricultural areas were forced to migrate.
1.5 million people.
They had to leave their ancestral lands and move into the peripheries of the major urban centers to find work, water, and basic survival necessities.
So you have a massive internal displacement, 1.5 million people suddenly knocking on the door of the cities. What does that look like when that pressure hits the institutional layer in those urban centers?
It acts as an overwhelming stress test on the existing plumbing of the society.
The local institutions.
Prior to the drought, Syria's urban centers were already grappling with existing institutional constraints. There were high levels of youth unemployment, economic inequality, and housing shortages.
The system was already strained.
When this massive, rapid influx of displaced, economically devastated people arrived in the cities, the existing economic and political frameworks simply could not absorb the shock.
The plumbing broke.
The local municipal infrastructures were overwhelmed. The governance systems failed to provide adequate economic safety nets, housing, or integration strategies for the displaced populations.
So the institutional layer essentially buckled under the weight of the life ground failure.
And just like the Maya, once the institutions buckle, the pressure shoots straight up into the cultural layer.
You have people who are physically displaced, economically ruined, and feeling ignored by the institutions that are supposed to manage the society.
Exactly. And in 2011, amidst the broader regional context of the Arab Spring, protests began.
Right.
But because the institutions were already weakened and perceived as incapable of or unwilling to alleviate the systemic stress, the situation rapidly escalated beyond mere political grievance.
It moved to the cultural layer.
Competing narratives emerged. As the state responded, and as various factions formed, the cultural narratives shifted toward existential struggle and strict, polarized group identities.
The society fragmented entirely.
What began as an acute ecological disturbance in the agricultural heartland cascaded through municipal and national institutional failure.
And eventually erupted into a highly complex, multi-sided armed conflict fueled by deep cultural polarization. It's the exact same architectural failure as the Maya, separated by over 1,000 years.
Same underlying mechanics.
An ecological disturbance hits the life ground. The institutions lack the flexibility or capacity to manage the stress, and the cultural narratives shape a response that spirals into defensive conflict rather than cooperative adaptation.
If we connect this to the bigger picture.
Yeah, please do.
It really forces you to step back and realize that civilizations rarely, if ever, fail from a single isolated cause. The profound lesson from these case studies is that collapse is an emergent property.
An emergent property.
It is never just the climate, or just the economic policy, or just the cultural friction.
It's all of them together.
It is the specific interaction of ecological pressure, institutional constraints, and cultural rigidity pushing a society beyond its viable operating limits.
It's terrifying to think about a modern society collapsing from a drought or from a shift in a weather pattern.
It should give us pause.
But what's crazier to me is that we usually don't even notice the drought. We only notice the riots in the streets.
We look at the surface.
Why is human psychology wired to only see the final explosion? Why do we only realize the house is failing when the roof actually caves in?
That naturally transitions us into the work of Johann Galtung.
Right. The paper relies heavily on his work to explain this blind spot.
Johann Galtung was a foundational figure in peace and conflict studies, And his work perfectly complements this architectural model.
The violence triangle.
Galton conceptualized violence not merely as physical acts of aggression, but as a structure. He created the violence triangle.
Okay, let's look at the layers of this triangle.
At the very top of this triangle, the visible tip of the iceberg, is direct violence.
The stuff we see on the news?
This is what commands our attention. It is warfare, armed conflict, police brutality, terrorism, physical assault. It is visible, it has clear actors. Someone is committing the violence against someone else.
And it dominates our news cycles completely.
But Galton argued that direct violence is merely the symptom. It rests upon and is generated by two deeper, largely hidden layers of the triangle.
Right. And beneath direct violence is what he called structural violence.
Structural violence.
And this concept really shifted my perspective. Structural violence is when the institutions of a society are organized in a way that systematically prevents individuals or populations from meeting their basic life necessities.
It's built in.
It doesn't necessarily have a single villain pulling a trigger. It's baked right into the rules of the game.
Let's explore a concrete example of that. Because it is insidious, precisely because it is invisible.
Okay, give me an example.
Imagine a city that, decades ago, routed a major industrial highway directly through a specific low-income neighborhood.
That happens all the time.
Over generations, the residents of that neighborhood suffer from drastically higher rates of asthma, cardiovascular disease, and lower life expectancy due to the constant particulate pollution.
So they are physically harmed.
Furthermore, the highway destroyed the local economic base, leading to generational poverty.
Right.
There is no individual person actively physically attacking these residents today. But the architectural design of the city's infrastructure and its economic policies are actively reducing their lifespan and life capacities.
That is structural violence.
It is a failure of the institutions to properly manage the life ground for all citizens.
It's the harm baked right into the rules. Another example the paper touches on is an economic system that concentrates vast resources at the very top.
While systematically leaving large populations without access to basic life-saving healthcare.
The deprivation is a policy outcome. It's not an accident.
Exactly.
But if structural violence is causing so much harm, how does a society tolerate it? Why don't people dismantle those systems immediately?
That is where the third point of the triangle comes in. Cultural violence.
Cultural violence.
Cultural violence operates entirely at the level of meaning, ideology, and interpretation. It is the moral legitimation of harm.
The stories we tell to justify it.
It consists of the narratives, the historical myths, the religious interpretations, or the economic dogmas that a society uses to justify its structural inequalities.
Making it seem normal.
Cultural violence makes the structural deprivation seem natural, inevitable, or even morally correct.
So going back to your example of the neighborhood polluted by the highway.
Right.
If the broader society looks at the high mortality and poverty rates in that zip code and says, well, that's just a bad neighborhood.
The people there don't work hard enough.
They don't value education. It's their own fault.
That narrative is cultural violence.
It completely ignores the structural reality of the highway and the pollution, and it blames the victims for their own systemic deprivation.
It justifies the status quo. It cleanses the conscience of the broader society.
So they don't have to fix it.
It allows the structural violence to continue uninterrupted. And the critical insight from integrating Galton's triangle with the paper's framework is this.
What's the link?
Direct violence is a lagging indicator.
A lagging indicator.
When that polluted, economically deprived neighborhood finally erupts in unrest, the broader society acts shocked and points to the direct violence as the problem.
Look at the riots.
But the direct violence is merely a blaring siren. It is an alarm bell telling us that the civilizational architecture has been severely misaligned with the life ground for a very long time.
Here's where it gets really interesting.
Oh, I agree.
The paper doesn't just stop at sociology or political science to explain this cascade of violence. It takes a hard pivot into human biology.
Neurobiology.
Because civilizations aren't just abstract architectural models. They are made up of millions of biological organisms. Us.
Biological nervous system.
And when our life ground is threatened, our biology reacts in highly predictable evolutionary ways.
Very predictable.
How does a macroeconomic failure or a structural inequality turn into a biological nervous system response?
To bridge that gap, the authors utilize Stephen Porges' polyvagal theory.
Polyvagal theory.
It provides a biological lens for understanding social behavior and societal shifts.
Okay, break that down for me.
The core idea is that our autonomic nervous system, which controls our heart rate, digestion, and subconscious stress responses, regulates our behavior through three broad evolutionary modes.
Three modes.
And it shifts between these modes based on how safe we perceive our environment to be.
Walk me through these three modes, because understanding this feels like getting the cheat code to human behavior.
It really does. The first and most evolutionarily recent mode is the ventral vagal state.
Ventral vagal.
This is the mode of safety and social engagement. When our nervous system subconsciously detects that our environment is safe, we have food, shelter, community support, this system activates.
We feel okay.
Biologically, it slows the heart rate, relaxes the facial muscles, and allows for the activation of the higher cortical functions of the brain.
The thinking part.
In this state, humans are capable of incredible nuance. We can listen to opposing viewpoints without feeling attacked. We can collaborate, invent complex technologies, engage in long-term planning.
So this is the good state.
It is the biological prerequisite for what we consider civilization.
It's the state where we are actually capable of being reasonable humans.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens when the environment stops feeling safe?
The shift happens.
Say the life ground starts failing or the structural violence becomes acute.
When we perceive danger, the nervous system drops into the second mode. Sympathetic activation.
The sympathetic state.
This is the classic threat state. Mobilization, fight or flight. Blood flow is diverted from the digestive system and the prefrontal cortex.
The reasoning part of the brain.
Right. It's pumped into the muscles. The body physically prepares for defensive action.
Ready to fight.
And cognitively, our world narrows. We become highly vigilant, highly sensitive to group identity, and we view outsiders with suspicion.
Nuance is gone.
Nuance completely vanishes. Because in a life or death situation, nuance is a liability. You need to make snap judgments to survive.
I think we all experience micro versions of this.
Absolutely.
Think about the feeling of missing a connecting flight at a chaotic airport, or trying to navigate a crowded grocery store the day before a major holiday when everything is out of stock.
Your heart rate elevates.
Your patience evaporates, and suddenly every other person in that store isn't a fellow citizen. They are an obstacle between you and the last carton of eggs.
You lose your capacity for grace.
Exactly. Now, what happens if the threat is even more severe than that?
If the threat is overwhelming, inescapable, or chronic, the nervous system drops into the third most primitive mode, the dorsal vagal state.
Dorsal.
This is the extreme threat response. It results in immobilization, dissociation, shutdown, and collapse.
It's freezing.
It's the biological equivalent of a reptile playing dead to avoid a predator. In humans, it manifests as profound apathy, depression, and social withdrawal. The organism simply gives up trying to fight.
Now, take that biological reality of a single human nervous system and scale it up.
Millions of people.
The paper discusses this concept of collective nervous systems. Because of mass media, the 24-hour news cycle, social media algorithms, and political rhetoric, the emotional and physiological responses of millions of people can be synchronized.
It ripples through the population.
If there is a sudden economic crisis, a pandemic, or a prolonged environmental disaster, fear literally ripples through the collective nervous system. Millions of people are shifted into sympathetic threat activation simultaneously.
And this is where the role of institutions becomes biologically critical.
The middle layer again.
Within this framework, institutions are not just administrative bodies. They act as safety-generating systems.
The safety generators.
The paper talks about the civil commons. Things like reliable access to clean water, functional public health systems, predictable rule of law, accessible education.
The basics of a functioning society.
When the civil commons are working effectively, they reduce ambient chronic stress in the population. They literally send biological signals of safety to millions of citizens.
Keeping everyone calm.
Keeping the collective nervous system anchored in that ventral vagal state of social engagement.
So if a society has strong functioning institutions, it can afford the luxury of pluralism, scientific inquiry, and open debate.
Because the people feel safe.
But imagine a society under chronic, relentless structural stress. Inflation is out of control, housing is unaffordable, the infrastructure is crumbling, and the political system seems entirely unresponsive.
The collective nervous system shifts into collective threat mode.
The population physically and biologically loses its capacity for cognitive complexity. People naturally begin to simplify the world into us versus them. When you feel economically terrified, your brain doesn't want to sit down and listen to a nuanced 10-point policy debate on tax reform. It wants to know who the enemy is and how to defeat them.
That is the exact mechanism. The biological shift into threat mode creates incredibly fertile ground for specific defensive cultural narratives to take root.
Cultural narratives?
People actively seek out stories that match their internal physiological state of alarm.
If you feel threatened, you want a story about a threat.
If your body is screaming that you are in danger, you will reject a narrative of peace and complexity, and you will latch onto a narrative of conflict and simplicity.
Which transitions us perfectly into understanding what the paper calls cultural attractors.
A cultural attractor.
I love this concept, though it is a bit unsettling when you recognize it in the real world.
It is very recognizable.
The paper defines cultural attractors as recurring narrative patterns that societies naturally and predictably adopt when they are confronted with instability and stress.
The stories we tell under pressure.
They are the psychological stories we tell ourselves when the collective nervous system is stuck in fight or flight.
The authors detail three specific defensive cultural attractors that reliably emerge under systemic stress.
Let's break them down.
Let's do it, because they act as diagnostic markers for societal health. The first is CMT, chosenness myth trauma.
Chosenness myth trauma.
This is a remarkably powerful and dangerous psychological cocktail.
Walk me through the mechanics of CMT. How does that narrative function to bind a group together when they feel threatened?
It operates by combining three powerful concepts. First is chosenness, the belief that a specific demographic, nation, or religious group has a unique, divine, or historical destiny that elevates them above others.
We are the special ones.
Second is a shared mythic identity about their inherent virtues and glorious past.
We used to be great.
But the binding agent is trauma. It is the intense, shared memory of past persecution, historical grievances, or victimization.
They hurt us.
Under stress, these historical grievances become the absolute core of the group's political identity.
So it creates an impenetrable in-group solidarity. We are special, we were wronged, and the world is out to get us.
That's the narrative.
I can see how biologically that feels very safe if you are in a threat state. You know exactly who your tribe is.
You know who is with you.
But it must be incredibly dangerous for anyone outside the tribe.
It is highly destabilizing for the broader society because it heavily justifies defensive mobilization and preemptive aggression against anyone perceived as an outsider.
Because if they hurt us before, they'll hurt us again.
If your core identity is based on past trauma, any compromise feels like a repetition of that trauma.
Wow.
Which leads us to the second defensive attractor.
Yeah.
DMA, which stands for Dualism, Manichaeism, Armageddon.
Dualism, Manichaeism, Armageddon. That sounds like the plot of a fantasy novel.
It does sound dramatic.
What does DMA look like in actual political discourse?
It is the ultimate cognitive simplification. DMA is when the collective brain simplifies a complex, multifaceted crisis into absolute stark moral binaries.
Black and white.
Dualism divides the world strictly into two camps. Manichaeism frames those camps purely in terms of absolute good versus absolute evil. There is no gray area.
Good guys and bad guys.
And Armageddon implies that the conflict between these two forces is existential and final.
A battle to the death.
In a DMA narrative, the political opponent isn't merely a fellow citizen with a flawed idea. They are an existential threat, a demonic force that must be entirely eradicated.
The danger of that in a connected world is terrifying. If you view the opposing political party not as competitors, but as literal evil attempting to destroy your way of life.
That any attempt at negotiation or compromise is seen as moral betrayal or treason.
You can't compromise with evil.
You simply can't.
You can see how this completely paralyzes the institutional layer. If the institutions are built to negotiate solutions, but the cultural narrative says negotiation is treason, the plumbing completely locks up.
Exactly. The system freezes. Mm. And the third defensive attractor is RP, repression projection.
Repression and projection.
This occurs when a society has deep internal structural tensions, perhaps massive economic inequality, widespread corruption, or a failing life ground.
Internal problem.
That are creating severe societal anxiety. Rather than doing the difficult, painful work of confronting and restructuring those internal failures.
Which it takes time and effort.
The society subconsciously represses the internal problem. They look away from it. And instead, they project the blame and the anxiety onto a scapegoat.
So if the middle class is collapsing because of automated labor and financial deregulation, instead of fixing the economic code, the narrative projects the blame onto a marginalized minority group
Or immigrants.
or a shadowy foreign power.
Yes.
It acts as a psychological relief valve. It gives the anxious population a target for their sympathetic threat energy without actually challenging the structural violence.
It avoids the real issues while drastically escalating the potential for direct violence against the targeted group.
Okay, it's a misdirection.
It is a misdiagnosis of the systemic alarm bell. It is vital to realize that these three attractors, CMT, DMA, and RP, are not just cynical political campaign strategies engineered by bad actors.
Though they are exploited by them.
Fundamentally, they are natural, almost algorithmic, psychological responses to the failure of the life ground and our institutions.
It's just what happens when we're stressed.
They are the cognitive interface of biological systemic stress. They are what the human brain does when it is afraid.
But thankfully, the paper doesn't just leave us in the dark.
No, it offers a way out.
It contrasts these defensive, fear-based narratives with a goal state, a healthy cultural attractor that societies can operate within when they feel secure.
HDT.
Right, they call it HDT. Holism Dialectics Transcendence. This sounds like the ventral vagal state translated into culture.
That is a perfect correlation. HDT is the integrative cultural orientation that emerges when the civil commons are functioning and the collective nervous system is regulated.
When we feel safe.
Holism is the mature recognition that our problems are interconnected, that you cannot separate the economy from the ecology or public health from infrastructure.
Seeing the whole picture.
Dialectics is the capacity to sit with tension. It is the ability to examine opposing viewpoints, recognize the valid concerns in both, and analyze the contradictions without immediately resorting to violence or fleeing.
Mature debate.
And transcendence is the ability to synthesize those opposing views into novel, higher-order solutions that move beyond binary us versus them thinking.
HDT is the culture of scientific inquiry, of democratic debate, and of innovation.
It is the pinnacle of civilizational thought.
So, as someone listening to this, the obvious question you're probably asking yourself right now is, how do we keep our society in that HDT state?
How do we stay safe?
How do we prevent the collective nervous system from sliding into the trauma and Armageddon narratives of CMT and DMA?
And the paper's answer is very structural.
We have to keep our civilization operating safely inside what it calls the viability corridor.
This raises an important question. How do we measure that viability? To explain the mechanics of the viability corridor, the paper introduces a conceptual viability function.
Okay, some math.
It is expressed mathematically as V equals a function of L, I, and C.
Viability equals life ground, institutions, culture.
Viability is a function of life ground integrity, institutional capacity, and cultural coherence. But the key to this equation is that these three variables act multiplicatively, not additively.
Meaning they multiply against each other. What does that imply for civilizational risk?
It implies that if any single one of those variables drops to near zero, the viability of the entire civilization crashes.
Regardless of the others.
Regardless of how exceptionally strong the other two are.
That makes perfect sense. If your life ground drops to zero because the local aquifer completely dries up and there is no water, it absolutely does not matter if you have the most robust democratic constitution in the world.
Or if your culture is deeply rooted in HDT and high social trust.
The society physically cannot exist without water. The viability is zero.
Conversely, you could have abundant natural resources, a perfect life ground. But if your institutions are entirely corrupt and incapable of distributing those resources,
Or if your culture is consumed by DMA polarization and endless civil war.
the viability still crashes. The viability corridor is the safe, dynamic operating range where all three of these variables are sufficiently strong and aligned.
Keeping balance.
If you stay within that corridor, the society is resilient. It can absorb shocks like a pandemic or an economic downturn and bounce back.
If we drift outside of it, we risk the cascading failure we saw with the Maya.
Exactly.
Which begs the question, how do we diagnose that civilizational risk before the collapse happens? We don't want to be the society that only realizes it's out of the corridor when the direct violence starts.
We need early detection.
How do we know if we are drifting? The author suggests we need to rigorously monitor early warning signals across all three layers.
This is where the framework becomes highly actionable for policymakers and citizens. For the life ground, the early warning indicators are biophysical.
What are we measuring?
We must monitor water security, the depletion rates of critical aquifers, the parts per million of atmospheric carbon, soil degradation rates, and biodiversity loss.
Checking the physical vital signs.
Are the foundational ecological support systems losing their carrying capacity?
And for institutional indicators, what are we looking at?
We look at the friction in the system. We monitor infrastructure reliability. Are the power grids failing more frequently during routine weather events?
That's a huge tell.
We measure governance legitimacy. Do citizens actually trust the courts, the electoral process, and the public health directives?
And crisis response.
Yes. Evaluate crisis response capacity. When a shock hits, does the institutional machinery coordinate effectively, or does it fracture into jurisdictional infighting?
And finally, for cultural indicators, we monitor the psychological state of the society.
The cultural mood.
We look at the level of polarization in public discourse. Is there a measurable erosion of a shared empirical reality?
Are citizens living in entirely isolated, antagonistic information ecosystems?
Is social trust between neighbors and strangers evaporating? Are the defensive attractors, the CMT and DMA narratives, becoming mainstream political rhetoric?
And when a society sees these warning lights flashing red, they need a systematic way to figure out exactly what part of the engine is broken.
To fix it.
To do this, the paper offers a brilliant analytical tool called the constraint diagnostic flow.
Constraint diagnostic flow.
It helps decision makers distinguish between two radically different types of problems, physical constraints versus institutional constraints.
Let's use an analogy to break this down, because confusing these two seems to be a major source of political paralysis.
It absolutely is.
Let's look at a housing crisis.
That is an excellent application. If a city is facing a massive housing shortage, the constraint diagnostic flow asks, is this a physical constraint?
Meaning?
Meaning, has the city literally run out of physical land to build upon? Or have we exhausted the global supply of lumber and concrete?
Is it physically impossible to build?
Or is it an institutional constraint? Meaning, we have abundant land, materials, capital, and labor. But our local zoning laws, our financial speculation models, and our labyrinthine permitting processes make it artificially impossible to construct the housing.
The distinction is critical because the solutions are entirely different.
Completely different.
If it's an institutional constraint, you can fix it by rewriting the code of the society. You change the zoning laws, you adjust the tax incentives, you fix the plumbing.
It requires political will.
But if it's a true physical constraint, if the aquifer is empty, no amount of political debate or new legislation will magically manifest water.
You have to fundamentally alter the consumption patterns of the civilization.
And historically, we spend vast amounts of political energy arguing over institutional constraints as if they were physical laws of nature,
while simultaneously ignoring the actual physical limits of the life ground.
This framework forces us to diagnose reality accurately.
It does.
It makes me picture this incredible idea, a viability dashboard for society.
A dashboard.
Imagine if you turned on the evening news, and instead of the lead story being a minute-by-minute update on the stock market indices or the latest partisan Twitter feud, the lead story was the National Viability Dashboard.
That would change everything.
Imagine anchors reporting on the regenerative capacity of the local watershed, the current baseline of soil health in the agricultural belt, the Gini coefficient of wealth inequality, and the current index social trust.
It would completely reorient the cognitive focus of the civilization. Integrating these holistic life value metrics into our daily feedback loops is the only way to ensure we remain within the viability corridor.
We have to see the data to act on it.
By elevating this biophysical and institutional data to the center of our cultural attention, we can move from a state of constantly reacting to sudden crises to actively and consciously designing for long-term survival.
Which brings us to the final, and I think the most hopeful, concept in the paper.
The transition.
Once we have this dashboard, once we understand the architecture of our society and the biology of our stress, what is the next step in human evolution?
The authors suggest we are currently attempting a transition.
From unconscious evolution to what they call reflexive governance or a reflexive civilization.
To fully appreciate this transition, we have to recognize our current geological reality. We're firmly in the Anthropocene.
The age of humans.
Human industrial activity is now the dominant influence on the Earth's climate, its atmospheric chemistry, and its ecosystems.
We are running the show.
For almost all of human history, civilizations evolved unconsciously. They adapted to their local environments through trial and error. They expanded, they consumed, and if they overshot their local carrying capacity, they collapsed locally.
They couldn't see the big picture.
They did not have the capacity to see the global picture. But today, the paradigm has shifted. We possess unprecedented planetary awareness.
It's the ultimate double-edged sword. We have become the meteor that causes the mass extinction, but we are also the first meteor in the history of the planet that has the capacity to look at its own trajectory and steer.
A meteor with a steering wheel.
We have satellites tracking ocean temperature anomalies in real time. Epidemiological networks monitoring viral mutations across continents. Vast data systems tracking global supply chains.
We can observe the health of the global life ground continuously.
We possess the dashboard, we just haven't fully integrated it into the steering wheel.
A reflexive civilization is one that utilizes this planetary awareness to consciously monitor and proactively adjust its own behavior.
Looking before we leap.
It is a society that doesn't just blindly consume resources until it hits a biophysical wall. It actively watches the dials on the viability dashboard and structurally aligns its institutions and its economy to stay safely within the corridor.
And doing that requires a massive shift in our cultural ethics.
It does.
It requires a deep commitment to intergenerational responsibility. Civilizational viability means acknowledging that the decisions we make today regarding carbon emissions, soil depletion, and water management will literally dictate the physical constraints placed upon our grandchildren.
A conscious civilization doesn't just extract. It actively stewards the planet.
And the authors do not leave this as a utopian dream.
No, they have a plan.
The paper lays out a very clear, sequential pathway for how a society actually manages this transition. It's a four-step process.
Step one is immediate stabilization.
Stop the bleeding.
You cannot remodel the house while it is on fire. You must stop the acute bleeding. This means immediately protecting critical water sources, securing food supplies, and ensuring that vulnerable populations survive the immediate environmental or economic shocks.
Bringing the stress down.
It requires. Then comes step three, economic reorientation.
Follow the money.
This is where the real structural shift happens. It involves aggressively shifting capital investments away from extractive degenerative industries and directing them entirely toward renewable energy infrastructure, circular economies, and regenerative agriculture.
It is aligning the financial incentives with the survival of the biosphere.
And finally, step four is cultural transformation.
The top layer.
As the institutions and the economy realign to provide genuine security, the ambient stress on the population decreases. This opens the space for fostering narratives of shared planetary responsibility.
We move to HDT.
The culture can naturally shift away from the defensive attractors of chosenness and trauma and move toward the HDT mindset, holism, dialectics, and transcendence.
And the paradoxical, somewhat wild observation the authors make is that massive crises are often the very catalysts that accelerate this entire four-step transition.
The breakdown forces the breakthrough.
Right. When the old systems visibly fail to protect the population, it shatters the cultural violence that was justifying the status quo.
It creates the political momentum and the cultural urgency required for rapid realignment.
We are living in a remarkably open historical moment. We possess the scientific knowledge, the real-time data, and the institutional frameworks to understand these dynamics.
The overarching question the paper poses is simply whether we will consciously use these tools to build a viable, reflexive future, or if we will remain unconscious and allow the cascading failures to consume us.
That is the ultimate choice. It is a question of structural maturity. So what does this all mean?
If we synthesize the entirety of this framework, it means that the survival of our civilization isn't just about winning the next partisan election cycle or waiting for a magic bullet technological invention to save us.
It's bigger than that.
It is fundamentally an architectural challenge. It is about consciously aligning our middle layer, our political and economic institutions, and our top layer, our cultural narratives and identities, with the bottom layer.
The biophysical ecological life ground that literally keeps us breathing.
If we protect and secure the foundation, the house can weather the coming storms.
I want to take a moment to talk directly to you, the listener. Thank you. Thank you for taking this incredibly deep, heavy, but absolutely vital journey with us today.
It's a lot to process.
When you grasp this violence viability framework, when you can clearly visualize the life ground, the institutions, and the culture constantly interacting, the chaotic, often terrifying daily news cycle suddenly makes so much more sense.
You see the matrix.
You realize you aren't just seeing random acts of geopolitical anger or isolated economic failures, you are watching the predictable physics of systemic stress playing out across a global architecture in real time.
It provides a powerful, clarifying lens that cuts straight through the superficial noise. It empowers us to diagnose the root causes of our challenges and ask the right structural questions about the resilience of our local communities and our global systems.
It absolutely does. And I want to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over on your commute or while you go about your day. We talked extensively about how, under polyvagal theory, civilizations function like a massive collective nervous system.
Right.
And right now, across the globe, we are feeling the intense symptoms of chronic stress. Ecological crises, institutional gridlock, economic anxiety, and geopolitical conflict. So the question is this: are we, as a global species, currently experiencing a planetary panic attack?
A planetary panic attack.
And if we are, what is the societal equivalent of taking a deep, regulating breath to get us back into that safe, engaged, and cooperative state of mind? Think about what that collective deep breath looks like in your own community. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Stay curious, keep questioning the systems around you, and keep learning.